Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Obama in China, healthcare crunch time, mammogram furor, and 9/11 trials headed to New York this week. Senate Democrats unveiled their health reform bill. All eyes now on whether they can get it to the floor for debate. Here's Senator Chris Dodd.
Many of those who came before us have tried to achieve what we're on the cusp of doing, and that is achieving the kind of national health coverage that Americans have been long waiting for.
Attorney General Eric Holder announced 9/11 trials in Manhattan. Republican Senator John Kyle asked why.
How could you be more likely to get a conviction in federal court when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is already asked to plead guilty before military commission and be executed?
And President Obama makes his first trip to Asia, eye to eye with China, and he hopes shoulder to shoulder.
The notion that we must be adversaries is not predestined, not when we consider the past. Indeed, because of our cooperation, both the United States and China are more prosperous and more secure.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Can Harry Reid get it done in the Senate on health care? Should he? Are mammograms fair game in the debate? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington, Jill Lawrence, columnist for PoliticsDaily.com, was a longtime reporter for USA Today. Jill, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Matt Continetti, staff writer for the Weekly Standard. His new book is The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. Matt Continetti, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from New York, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. She writes the Editor's Cut blog there. She's a contributor to The Nation's own Sarah Palin book, Going Rouge, An American Nightmare. Katrina, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Jill, bring us up to date first on this health care debate, where it stands, the vote. We're hearing now maybe tomorrow night Harry Reid is not promising that he can get 60 votes together. Where's the swing in this? After all this Sturm und Drang and debate, what's it going to take for the Democrats to get something on the floor for debate, Jill?
Well, you know, the Democrats looked really euphoric the other night when they were talking about bringing this to the floor. And I think that Harry Reid has been talking to so many people for so long, he has a real good sense of where people are. As I've been told that there's really only one vote that's in doubt of the 60, and it's most likely going to happen. All we're talking about really is bringing it to the floor. And I think that, Harry Reid is kind of in a zen state at this point. There's only one way to find out if he's got the votes to do anything, and that's to do it. Go ahead and do it. So I think once he gets it on the floor, and I think that he wouldn't be pushing this if he didn't think he had a pretty good shot, you know, then we just see a series of votes. We see what'll work, what won't work, and eventually they'll pass something, I would guess.
Do we know who that vote is, Jill, who that one vote, that swing vote is at this point?
If I had to guess, I would say it's Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas. I think you're going to see people, there's a few holdouts, like Senator Ben Nelson from Nebraska. I think he's probably going to make his announcement today. People are coming to the fore with how they're going to vote, and this is just an open debate. And so I think by the time it happens, we may know that it's going to happen.
And this is all to open debate on the bill itself, to see whether they can get it out there and begin work on it. Here's Reid, Harry Reid, from a press conference yesterday, saying the bill would save lives and money.
So not only do we make it more affordable for every American, we also certainly do it in a fiscally responsible way. We're not going to add a dime to the deficit. In fact, quite the opposite. We'll cut the problems we have with money around here by as much as $750 billion.
Not exactly a ball of charisma, but it's in his corner right now. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor yesterday going after the Democrats' health bill.
If you have insurance, you get taxed. If you don't have insurance, you get taxed. If you need a life-saving medical device, you get taxed. If you need prescription medicines, you get taxed.
Matt Continetti, Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, threatened to read the entire bill aloud on the floor of the Senate to delay the vote. He's backed off of that, I guess. But do you see this thing passing and opening up to debate, Matt, or not at this point?
Well, I think the chances of the motion to proceed passing are greater than the chances that it will fail. I think the concern is less, the concern the Democrats should have is less the Republicans are going to just do, you know, scorched earth warfare to, in order to defeat this bill. And, of course, public opinion is on the Republican side. The public continues to disapprove of the Democrats' health care plans. But more worrisome for the Democrats, I think, are people like Joe Lieberman, people like Ben Nelson. We heard Blanche Lincoln's name, Mary Landrieu's another, the Mark Warner from Virginia, who's been relatively silent on all of this debate. Mm. These red state Democrats, Lieberman's not a red state Democrat, but he's an independent Democrat. Mm. The red state Democrats and the independent Democrats, I think, if anyone is going to sink the bill, it will be them.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, how about that? Republicans have public opinion on their side. Do you agree? And will the Democrats be lined up to get at least the debate open here?
Matt may have been spending a lot of time on the Sarah Palin bubble tour. I have not seen the polls he's seen. I've seen polls showing that public opinion continues to be on the side of some kind of public option, and that's not the Republican plan I last read. I do agree with him that the Democrats have a problem with holdouts, people who not necessarily representing their constituency as much as the insurance companies and big pharma. You know, I start with the fundamental proposition that health care is a right, not a commodity, and that brings security and stability to millions of Americans. Expanding a program that has remained the unfinished work of this country is fundamental. Harry Reid, you heard, he's a master tactician, as you said, Tom, no ball of fire, no ball of charisma, but he may well, you know, do the fundamental first step, which is that Americans and the Senate, certainly the Senate owes their constituents to allow this debate to take place, and then the fight begins. Take it to the floor and duke it out. And what will emerge is, you know, going to be flawed, and then that becomes a building block, but it's going to, it will expand access in fundamental and important ways and do things like ensure that insurance companies don't deny coverage for pre-existing conditions, et cetera. So these are fundamental issues, and let the debate begin.
Of course, it's been a big debate, and right into the middle of it this week came these new guidelines on mammograms saying women 40 to 50 do not need. A big change got a lot of women very upset and then was quickly characterized by opponents of health care reform as a taste of things to come. Here's Representative Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, saying the new recommendations for postponing mammograms until age 50, sign of things to come with, she said, government-run health care.
This is how rationing begins. This is the little toe in the edge of the water. And this is where you start getting a bureaucrat between you and your physician.
Jill Lawrence, we talked to the chair of the panel that came out with these recommendations this week on air. He said nothing to do with politics, came out way before. The members of the panel, you know, are not Obama appointees. What about the way this has gotten tangled a bit in the health care reform debate? Legitimate, Jill, or not?
Well, everything is about politics, you know. I wouldn't say it's not about politics. It came out as about medicine, and it quickly rose to the top of the health care debate. And you haven't seen that much logic or consistency in the arguments about bringing down the cost curve of growing costs on health. I mean, you have Republicans who seem to want to spend everything it takes, anything anyone wants on Medicare, even if that's going to break the system.
Though Democrats just had a vote like that this week, right?
On doctors, you talking about?
Yep.
Well, that's true. That is a flaw in a formula. Doctors need to be paid more. There's a situation that's got to be fixed. I think the problem is how to pay for it. I don't think too many people disagree that it needs to be fixed. But, you know, that's another element of the healthcare debate. In terms of the mammograms, you know, I read something this morning that you'd have to screen 1,900 women in their 40s for 10 years to save one life. And at that, it's an optional thing. You can do it if you think you need to or your doctor thinks you need to. So it's inevitable that any of these recommendations now from any of these medical groups are going to be entangled in politics, whether they're recommending more or less.
You're laid back on that front. A lot of women were not this week, I have to say.
Well, I mean, there's rationing already. You know, it's not the beginning of rationing. Anybody with an insurance plan knows there's rationing, and anybody without health insurance knows there's rationing.
Matt Continetti, what's your gut tell you here? There was a lot of talk about the inevitability of health care reform not too long ago. Now it's all hanging on a vote maybe tomorrow. Do you see this thing still one way or another rolling through, or could it all screech to a halt?
Well, I did write an editorial for the Weekly Standard last month about it's not inevitable. That said, I think the chances of something happening are still greater than the chances of it not happening. I want to return quickly to a point that Katrina made earlier. It's true that I do get out of the Sarah Palin bubble enough to log on to pollster.com,
okay,
where you see if you ask, do you approve or disapprove of the Democrats' health care and Obama's handling of the issue, more people disapprove than approve. She's right to say that people do like the public option when they're asked about it in isolation. But when you talk about the whole plan, more people disapprove than approve of it. And the reason, Pew just came out with the study today that's very interesting, the two top reasons why people don't like this plan are the cost and the idea that government is becoming more involved in healthcare. And I think that's I don't think that these new studies coming out from HHS and the advisory commissions have anything to do with rationing or have anything to do to get in between a patient and her doctor. But I do think the public is looking at it and saying, hold it, you know, I want everything possible to get the best care possible I can. And so they're going to just, I think, react negatively to decisions like these.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Obama in China, healthcare crunch time in the Senate, mammogram uproar, and Oprah to sign off, she says, at least off of her network show. Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation is with us, Matt Continetti from The Weekly Standard, and Jill Lawrence from PoliticsDaily.com. Let's get a call from just over the border, Toronto, Canada. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I do think Harry Reid will get this health bill through, but he'll do it on the cheap, because what I mean by that is in much better days, when Hillary Clinton, the ardent advocate of healthcare, tried to get it through, it didn't go through. And now the U.S. is living in very austere times, and I fear that if it does go through, the U.S. health care system, if nationalized, will be less than a first world level system.
Well, I mean, you've got a different system in Canada that works okay, I guess. Frank, is yours third world?
Well, it's deteriorating, but we're keeping it going. But the Canadian the budget deficit or its economic situation is less dramatic when compared to the U.S. And when our health system came into being in the 1970s, there was a lot of money available for it. And I don't see where the money's going to come from right now in the U.S. when it's in economic doldrums.
Yeah, that's for sure. Katrina?
Yeah, I was going to jump in because Frank raises a good question. It's really, fundamentally, it's about priorities. And it's always fascinating to me that there's all this Congressional Budget Office scoring of these health plans, but there's no scoring of General McChrystal's plan to spend $200-300 billion over the next year or so in Afghanistan. The key question is how we allocate our resources. We are a rich country. We are a powerful country. I have been for Medicare for All. I think that would be the most efficient, would cut out millions of middlemen insurance costs. We're not there. I'm a realist. But I think we can afford to expand coverage for millions of Americans in this country who deserve that. So I suspect the Canadians look at us, as do many around this world, where they have far better healthcare systems, and wonder what is going on in this country in terms of its priorities.
The Congressional Budget Office says, of course, there's a lot of hemming and hawing about General McChrystal and what he wants in Afghanistan in the next year or years. But the CBO says that this package would cut the deficit by $130 billion. Republicans have said it will end up costing $1.5 trillion instead of the $849 billion. Jill Lawrence, are people buying the Congressional Budget Office's notion that this would be a deficit-reducing health reform package?
Well, you know, it's interesting about CBO. If they like its findings, they buy it. If they don't and they oppose the underlying bill, they criticize it. But I think, you know, in this case, the CBO themselves will say that it's very hard to predict these things. But there are specific ways that these bills raise money and save money. So I think anyone who's paying really close attention will see that it's a best guess and that it could work this way. And beyond that, it's one of the major goals of the people pushing the bill. So, I mean, you know, these are not set in stone. If it passes and it starts costing more, there'll be more tinkering along the way or you know, other ways of, or as people get used to different ways of doing things, if doctors do begin delivering coordinated care and not getting fee-for-service and ordering more and more tests, you know, if the comparative research goes well and people see that there are treatments that work, you know, 90% of the time, and start using those, and there are ways that these bills could save money.
That's what the CBO says. Of course, America's banker looking over our shoulder on this issue and just about every issue. China, where we owe $1 trillion, President Obama in Asia and in China this week. Here he is speaking to a group of young people in Shanghai. This was early in the week, about how the U.S., or at least he, was looking at China's increasingly large role in the world.
Power in the 21st century is no longer a zero-sum game. One country's success need not come at the expense of another. And that is why the United States insists we do not seek to contain China's rise. On the contrary, we welcome China as a strong and prosperous and successful member of the community of nations.
China, happy to be welcomed, but China's president, Hu Jintao, at a joint press conference with President Obama, no questions taken, thank you, said the two countries have important relationship, must be kept on track, but he wasn't into taking advice from anybody. Here, this is from China's state-backed CCTV.
During the talks, I underlined to President Obama that given our differences in national conditions, it is only normal that our two sides may disagree on some issues. What is important is to respect and accommodate each other's core interests and major concerns.
Matt Continente, you had the sense in this visit, at least to me, of the balance of power sort of, you know, reaching a kind of stasis here. And the next change may be obviously in China's favor, that President Obama was there, head held high, made a good impression, maybe made a little progress, but not on a lot of fronts. And China's power just manifests in every meeting.
Well, the Harvard historian Niall Ferguson refers to us as Chimerica, and the Chinese and the Americans are locked in this economic and geopolitical embrace. That said, it's going to be decades before China's economy matches the United States's, and decades as well until their military power reaches ours. But when I look at this trip to China, which is, you know, the most important economy in the world next to the United States, really, at this point, not the largest, but the most important, I think Obama did pretty badly. I think the crucial economic issue facing the global economy, and Paul Krugman on the left agrees with this, and Niall Ferguson, whom I just mentioned, on the right agrees with this, is the failure of the Chinese government to allow their currency, the renminbi, to appreciate. And Obama went over there now and tried to get them to say, no, you got to let it rise so that the dollar can, you know, these trade balances which dictate so much
Americans
of the global economy.
Americans can export more, right.
Exactly, right. And we need to ramp up demand, not necessarily in the United States, but in China to get the economy going again. And they didn't do anything. And they didn't do anything on Iran. They gave him no guarantees to back sanctions there. They gave him no guarantees to increase their environmental protections because they're the largest polluter in the world now. And they gave him no guarantees on the human rights issues. So Obama went there, I think, to acknowledge the Chinese's new importance. But I don't think he came back with much.
I wonder, Katrina Vandenhoeven, how you see this trip all over Asia, but in China in particular. There were not agreements on climate change, human rights certainly, Iran's nuclear program. I mean, the United States just doesn't look in a position to tell China what to do these days. I mean, is Obama now is the United States president now a supplicant there or something else?
You know, I agree with Matt that one of the most important issues in the U.S. Chinese relationship, perhaps the most important bilateral relationship, is this issue of the Chinese currency and how they've undervalued it and the danger that poses to our economic future. However, I'd like to challenge the conventional storyline that the U.S. press for the most part went along with, the New York Times writing that Obama was going there to, quote, assume the role of profligate spender coming to pay his respects to his banker. I mean, I think that, you know, the old story is when you owe $100,000, the bank owns you. When you owe $100 million, you own the bank. And that pretty aptly describes the U.S. relationship with China, which holds approximately 70% of its $2.3 trillion foreign reserves in dollars. They're not going to play around too much with that, and I think we're locked in this embrace. I also think, just one last point, you know, there's a lot of talk about how Obama's trip compared unfavorably to his predecessors, President Clinton's discussion of human rights, President Bush's repeated efforts to pressure the Chinese for religious freedom. Neither Clinton nor Bush succeeded in advancing either cause, no matter how profile their challenge to Beijing. And I think that President Obama, in a series of speeches over the last year, Cairo, Prague, Moscow, Accra, has begun to lay out an Obama doctrine. And one of those, and I respect it, in addition to his belief for a nuclear-free world, is a belief that human rights strengthen not through U.S. hectoring or intervention, but when people win for themselves their rights and liberties. And I think that within China, we are not paying enough attention to the ferment, the turmoil, the internal protests, which the Chinese government are very carefully managing through economic, social, and industrial policy. So I think, you know, Obama went, the underplaying of expectations was another storyline, and he was trying to recast the relationship as a thoughtful listener and not someone going to preach. And I don't think we are in any position to preach to countries around the world.
It looks like the days of preaching to China are well and truly maybe over. Jill, yes?
I was just going to say that, and it's possible that it's premature to judge the trip. You know, we may see things coming out of it that we haven't seen yet. This, I guess you could apply to the entire Obama administration, where there's, you know, judgments every day. But there may yet be something coming out of there on Iran. There may be some tangible progress on climate change. He's laid groundwork, and it may pay off.
Good. Let's take a call from Paul in Weston, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Paul. I've got a question about the style of the Chinese response, which is that the Chinese response is not to make a statement in the front of the press and the public, but rather to take things under advisement, determine what the special interests are within the Chinese environment itself, and then make a decision. So I think that the response of your panelists is interesting, but is looking at decision-making and how the Chinese should react from a U.S. point of view and not from a Chinese point of view. Yep. I'd like to kind of hear their response to that.
Paul, thanks very much. A lot of talk, Matt Continetti, this week about, of course, how Chinese leaders don't have the same latitude American leaders do. They sit on big councils, and they represent, you know, predetermined lines. They're not going to go in wheeling and dealing one-on-one, and famously, you know, do not, will not do that. On the other hand, you know, what's the pressure for them to wheel and deal at the American call here? They're in a pretty good position.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a fascinating country and a fascinating society. Katrina mentioned the real ferment and tumult. The Chinese government actually stopped publishing the number of what they call public disturbances or protests/riots because they were mushrooming. And so we really don't know what's going on in there. Look at it from
We know they've had incredible growth. It's made a lot of people very happy in China at the same time, while black prisons and people stuffed into jails and all the rest. But it's that mixed picture.
That's right. The coasts are profiting. But, of course, they've been affected by the economic downturn as well. That's one reason why they don't want the renminbi to appreciate, because the Chinese leadership continues to believe that their export-driven growth is going to be the way out of it. But what they really need to do, in my opinion and in the opinion of many other economists, or I'm not an economist, I'm a journalist, but the economists I read think this too, is that they need to spur their own internal consumer demand. We need to get the Chinese to start buying American products and products from other places around the world. But look at it from their point of view. I mean, they really, you know, the Chinese leadership is so bent on tamping down any social ferment that they want to continue on the path that they've already done, and they also want to continue down this path of what they call a peaceful rise, which is they biding their time and not kind of rocking the global boat. So they have no interest in helping the United States contain Iran through sanctions. And they have no real interest in bolstering environmental protocols, because they know that those protocols would squelch the growth. So, and of course, if they were to free up human rights, that would challenge the legitimacy of the government. And I do think Katrina, though, made a great point when she said that neither Bush nor Clinton nor the previous Bush made any progress on human rights.
Of course, we've all got an interest long term in the climate situation. Let's take a call from Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Medical reformers, the medical care reformers, consistently blame high medical costs on the insurance and pharmaceutical industries, and I think that blame is misplaced. I think the real problems with our system is that each year doctors are prescribing more and more expensive treatments, and the public is eager to consume these treatments. And how can the insurance companies work without charging high premiums to pay for all of this?
Yeah, there's a lot we want, and people looking at that system right now. Let us hold that one, Steve, and get one more. Kevin in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Kevin, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out, too, on the health care debate, where it's kind of hit a roadblock, is because people, I think, if they pay any attention to history, know that government has never come in on budget what they said things were going to cost. When Medicare came out in 65, there was projected costs which were greatly exceeded, and with every other additional Medicare health program government sponsored, they've been grossly underestimated what they cost. And that follows in with the Iraq wars,
yep.
Grossly underestimated. Well, the point being is that voters are having some hesitation because the history. Government basically has grossly underestimated the cost of everything they proposed. And finally, I just want to point out, we're in pretty bad shape when we're getting lectures on fiscal responsibility from a communist government in China.
Communist in name anyway, and certainly in government structure. But thank you, Kevin. I mean, Jill Lawrence, you can feel a lot of things coming together here. Our caller says American consumers want more and more. Well, maybe we don't have the economy for that. Kevin in Iowa says things cost more than they're promised. Maybe we don't have the budget for that. President Obama himself saying deficit's going to be his big theme next year. I mean, maybe we're just up against real limits at this point.
Well, I want to point out there are some programs that actually have cost less, and one of them is the Medicare prescription drug program, which has turned out to be much less expensive than the projections. And there are a couple of other ones, too. So it's not always the case that things cost more. I think you have to start from the premise here that we have 46 million people who don't have health coverage. And so they're trying to do so many things at once and in a bad economy. And yet at this time with people losing jobs, so many people losing jobs and losing health coverage, it's almost more of an imperative to do it now. So it's, I think a lot of this will ease when the economy improves, but that might not be for 2 years, 3 years. So we're in a situation where we have to look at both the expansion because of people going without, and we also are looking at ways to save money.
Katrina Vandenhoof, how about President Obama with facing the deficit and facing demands for services and all the rest? What's he do in this coming year?
Well, let me pick up on what Jill said, because I think she's so right about how there are very clear instances where you've seen the government's ability, for example, to negotiate lower prices. The whole idea of the public option, though too few may be enrolled, is very all-American. It's competition to lower prices. I think we face in this country what I would call a public investment deficit, that we have failed over these last years to use deficits wisely. You can use deficits to invest in productive things, not just tax cuts for the very wealthy or wars that may not make us more secure. Healthcare reform is an imperative, as Jill said, and I'm always surprised on my side of the aisle, many progressives say, well, he should have started with job creation. Well, I think the recovery program was partly that, but it was also to keep the economy from falling into the abyss. But healthcare is 1/6 of our economy, and it is imperative at a time of jobs crisis. I think one of the fundamental mistakes of the Obama administration was to throw money at these banks without demands that they lend, and have discredited government spending in some ways at a moment when we need it desperately for job creation.
Hold the thought. Jill Lawrence, Matt Continetti. We'll be right back with much more of the news of the week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, big protests in the California university system over a 32% fee increase. UCLA students took over a building.
We're going to work to make sure that first-generation college students don't become last-generation college students.
Lots of teen buzz around the opening today of the second Twilight vampire movie, New Moon.
You just don't belong in my world, Bella.
I belong with you.
This is the last time you'll ever see me. Please just promise me you won't do anything reckless.
And Oprah, big this week. She's announcing that she's ending her show, launching a cable channel, and of course, she had the week's big interview.
You've been waiting, I've been waiting, and she is finally here. Please welcome Sarah Palin.
There it is on Oprah, 2011. She'll be off the air on that show. Matt Continetti is with us today from the Weekly Standard. Jill Lawrence from PoliticsDaily.com. Katrina Vandenhoevel from The Nation magazine. Our own Jack Beatty is off in Vienna making a big speech. Good for him. Let's go to Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, two comments. The media had nothing to do with doing in Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin did herself in the moment she opened her mouth, and everybody discovered how vacuous she was. And second, when you think about the current Republican Party and the current conservatives, can you think of a more progressively backward group of people than these people? My God, they are so against the trend of history. They're so against the welfare of the American people. They are so concerned about the welfare of insurance companies, and they lie. I mean, the death panels and everything else. I mean,
Bill, we've got it, and we'll pick up the trends. Let's let Sarah Palin, for just a second, speak for herself here. Here she is kicking off her national tour for her new book, Going Rouge. This was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She appeared on Wednesday at a rally.
You can read my words unfiltered. Yeah! Much I appreciate all of you, and I just can't tell you how good it is to be back in Michigan. So thank you. Let's get to work.
Oh boy, Sarah Palin, going rogue, of course. Katrina Vandenhoevel, your book has gotten into my memory banks here. But let's pick it up. I don't know, Katrina. I'll come to you first on Sarah Palin. She's back. She's got big crowds coming out. Yeah. Really interestingly, she's headed into Fort Bragg soon for one of these book appearances, and the press will not be allowed because the Pentagon said they didn't want it to be used for political ends. What do you make of we'll come to you, Matt. I know you've got a different view, but what do you make of Sarah Palin's return and the big crowds, for example, that came out in Grand Rapids?
She's a phenomenon. I don't know what her future on the political scene will be as a candidate, but she's not leaving the building, so to speak. What strikes me about Palin, two things. One, the phenomenon of the sort of that she's a victim of the mainstream elite. I mean, give me a break. She was championed by a coterie of establishment conservatives, Bill Kristol, who was writing for the New York Times, a column, and Michael Gerson, a columnist at the Washington Post. And her book has been published by HarperCollins, the second largest media company in the world. So this notion that she's, you know, not getting a fair shake. But I also think she's a phenomenon because the way she intruded and brought herself into the healthcare debate is a measure of the danger of mendacity in our politics, and I use that word so as not to use a more vulgar word, but I mean, you know, this idea that optional end-of-life counseling paid for is something that is going to lead to euthanasia, so deformed and distorted our political debate and stoked the fear and the anger and the resentment that is at loose in this country at a time of economic pain, that I think that is a great danger, a kind of political, sociological phenomenon and danger moving forward in these next years, because there's going to be more pain in this country, and stoking, you know, the Republicans can use the pain to make the populist issue their own. I think it's hypocritical. Sarah Palin's answer to the jobs crisis is more tax cuts. But we have only two parties, and I wish the Republican Party was more open, more inclusive, and more reasonable, because I think they are driving out those who, for example, Northeastern moderate Republicans are becoming virtually extinct.
Matt, I'll come to you on that one. Let me get first Paul in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. This is Paul, and I've been here since 91. In the current administration, they want to send us back to Eastern Europe, to social life. I came from that life, and you don't want to go back. That's why I'm 1,000% supporter of Sarah Palin, and that's why you see all these tea parties going on. That's all my comments.
We got it, Paul, 1,000% supporter. Matt Continetti, there's our first caller, saying she is so against the trend of history. Sarah Palin herself this week talking about the lamestream media, and surely we'll hear more of that. You have celebrated her as a return to a kind of a welcome American populism, if I read you right, Matt. And, of course, you call her persecuted in your book, The Persecution of Sarah Palin. What do you say?
Right. Well, I think she's an authentic democratic figure. I think she's in a tradition of American politicians who are populists. She's a cultural populist, perhaps more than she's an economic populist. I personally would rather that she be more of an economic populist and go after things like the Obama administration's position on the banks. But you get a sense from the two calls just how divided the public is on Sarah Palin. She arouses great passion among her supporters and great revulsion among her detractors. She became one of the most polarizing figures in our politics in record time in the space of 8 weeks. And I think that was through some major missteps on her part, but I also think it was through some of the exaggerations and mistruths, misrepresentations that were told about her in the media.
We'll take James in Bowling Green, Kentucky on exactly that. James, you're on.
Yeah, I would just like to say that I'm also a supporter of Sarah Palin. I believe, though, a lot of problems, why there's such a big disconnect in this country with our leaders is because the media does not specifically demand answers from our these politicians that are running for office. They let them just answer with vague promises, but they don't specifically demand how they're going to make these promises come true, and I think that's a lot of the problem.
So be more rigorous on everybody, maybe Sarah Palin included, even though you're a supporter. Jill Lawrence, of course, back in that short campaign season after she was made John McCain's running mate, some of those interviews got pretty tough, and she ended up avoiding a lot of them. What do you see in the return of Sarah Palin this week, Jill?
Well, I guess I see more of the same. And 48 hours ago, less than 48 hours ago, I decided I wouldn't talk about her ever again.
Sorry.
But I guess that's, that's not going to happen. I guess what I see are personality traits that are now very cemented in the public mind. And one of them is an inability to move on. You know, what if she had written a book that had the part about growing up in Alaska and autobiographical, and then went on to her ideas for the country and skipped entirely the part about blaming other people for the failures of the campaign? That would have been an interesting book. You know, what does she think about things? What are her solutions? You could look at Barack Obama's website and find out every detail of what he wanted to do. In fact, the House health care bill tracks almost exactly with the health care plan he put out in May of 07. But you don't have that kind of creativity or ideas from Sarah Palin, at least not yet. At this point, maybe they'll come. Maybe we'll get her thinking. But she's raised a lot of doubts in a lot of people's minds about whether she's capable of that.
Let me stick with her for one more second. Mike, Franklin, Tennessee, you're on the air, Mike.
Nice to talk with you. Two things. Number one, I live in Marsha Blackburn's home district, and I can tell you, being in a totally red county, that she, in my opinion, is a Washington cocktail party queen. And what Mr. Continetti is proposing about Sarah Palin is also sort of troubling to me, because from what I can see, she's basically an empty suit. So we've got a strong Republican bias, it seems to be, to the discussion, and anything that the Obama administration does would probably be on their bad list of things to consider. Also, I spent 30 years in healthcare and have seen the abuses by doctors, hospitals, and things of that nature. I will step away and let you comment.
Thank you, Mike. Empty suit in Sarah Palin, a populist Matt Kentnetty celebrates, at least in part. Let's get another call right here from Detroit, Michigan. It's Sam. Sam, you're on the air.
I'm really disappointed in our president so far and his economic team of Summers and Geithner. And these teabaggers have a point, and it's us progressives on the left, our messages are coming together, and it's getting closer and closer to meeting together, and we're just going to be a populist uprising about how they're just bailing out Wall Street and giving away all this money, and nothing is going on for the people out here in the street. In Detroit, it's a disaster. I'm surprised UNICEF or the Red Cross isn't here yet. But this president, I think he's about to let his presidency go down the tubes if he doesn't take action on Geithner and Summers, because they have him on the wrong direction with his economic policy.
Sam, thanks very much for your call in Detroit. Katrina, yes, please.
Yeah,
teabaggers and progressives merging in disillusion. What are you saying?
Well, I just wanted to say I agree with Jill that what the memoir is a kind of payback memoir, and what we're not hearing are ideas or policies. That is not Sarah Palin's role, and it's partly the fault of our politics, which at its lowest point has been degraded into kind of infotainment. I also agree with your caller that the media's role is to hold politicians' feet to the fire and ask tough questions, but Sarah Palin is doing a kind of bubble tour. But more important, the issue of the Obama administration, probably the terrible misstep that is now poisoning the possibility of creating jobs with is that the massive taxpayer giveaway to what I think of as the banksters, the banks, and how that has fueled populist outrage. The problem is how you now channel that outrage. The way, it seems to me, which becomes politically very difficult, is to create the jobs that this country desperately needs and not to foment and play on resentment or fear. So you will have two different kinds of populism. Matt talked about Sarah Palin as a kind of cultural populism, but there is very much a right-wing economic populism afoot loose in the land. In some good ways, it fuses with progressive populism, where you sort of look at the Fed's power and say, hey, it failed us in the crisis. Let's not let it control our economy moving forward. But to, you know, ask Geithner or Summers to resign is only part of the problem. We need a systematic rethinking of how we move forward after we've given so much away to the banks with no demands. And that is a movement to organize around.
Matt Continetti, from your conservative perspective, what's the populism you most wish for? If Sarah Palin doesn't exactly embody it, what would you like to see on that front? Is it the teabag movement?
I think the Tea Partiers, who were, you know, anti-tax, anti-government spending, I mean, they represent a very vocal constituency, and they're reacting to what they're seeing in Washington, which disturbs them greatly. My populism is more of a free market populism. I believe in a commercial ideal. I think government should do measures to promote competition, to promote small business growth, and to allow individual innovative entrepreneurs get out there and create new ideas. And it's striking to me the populist elitist divide, which I do talk about a lot lately, is it's transpartisan. And I was struck
today. All kinds
of
populists, all kinds of elitists.
Yeah, I was struck today that, you know, my friend David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, who's called Sarah Palin a joke, he has a column today in the New York Times defending Tim Geithner.
Yeah.
So really, there's kind of a conservative center-right elitist, and you see how he's backing Geithner and demeaning Sarah Palin. That just really struck me as, yeah, these are the new kind of affiliations and constellations, configurations of power we have in the country. And it means the next couple of years are going to be very tumultuous in our politics, I think.
The times of ferment are here. Let me get Al. Oh, is it Jill?
Yes, it is Jill. Yeah. I just wanted to add one more thing, not to bring everything back to healthcare, but healthcare reform is very important to the entrepreneurial spirit in a couple of ways. The bills in the Congress now would let people stay on their parents' health care plans till they're 27. Mm-hmm. That means that graduates from college and graduate school, if they wanted to start a business, create something entrepreneurial, they could, and they wouldn't have to worry about health coverage. That's also true of anyone who wanted to leave a safe but boring job and create something.
Everybody's got that thread at their back now if they don't have it there. I want to get to one more subject here. Maybe Alvin will bring us. Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Alvin, you're on the air.
Yes, I'll be brief. Bottom line is, I don't understand the reason why they want to bring these Guantanamo Bay personnel into our legal system, because, number one, it's free publicity. Number two, there's a strong chance that they might get acquitted on some type of technicality, and there's a whole host of things that could go wrong.
Alvin, our time is short, but let us pick it up right there. Katrina, what about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the handful coming to Manhattan for these trials after looking at this decision for most of a week? What do you think of it?
Our federal courts have had a good record of dealing with terrorism-related cases. In fact, I think that 150 convictions, three in military commissions. You know, I think if you believe in the power of our ideas, the power of the rule of law, the power of our court system, I think this is the appropriate way to go. The Guantanamo camps became a symbol in the world, fueling anti-Americanism, probably inciting and fueling more danger. But
right.
So I think the courts are equipped. I think the courts are equipped. Now, one reason you may not be able to bring some of these cases to court is because of tainted evidence, meaning torture was used, quote, coerced evidence.
But what about
the legacy of the disaster of using torture, condoning torture as an American policy?
What about Senator Kyle's point we heard early in the show saying, look, if you've already got them professing, why not just take care of it there? And you've got the Attorney General saying failure is not an option. I mean, if it's not an option, then it's kind of sounds prejudged. You know, some people are saying, why not just take care of it at Guantanamo?
Because I think we need to stand firm for the very values and principles we claim to be fighting for in the struggle against terrorism. And that is why we need now to return to some of the core principles and do it in a way that balances security and liberty and is true to our traditions. And I think, as I said, the courts have a good record in this arena.
Matt Continetti, we're going to see the constitutional principles and liberty on display in these trials.
I think there's a danger, though, for this to turn into a big mess for the administration, because if there is a mistrial based on the evidence and evidence collection, there's no way that the administration is going to let these guys go free. So at the end of the day, they may undercut that very belief in our principles and our constitutional authorities.
Well, Eric Holder says failure is not an option. Interesting in itself, but we will all be watching that one. Matt Continetti with the Weekly Standard, Jill Lawrence with PoliticsDaily.com, and Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Thanks to each of you for being here this hour. Really appreciate your time. Jack Beatty will be back next week. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.